morning, everybody. We want to thank Sher Shemayim and the rabbi of Sher Shemayim, who's a good friend of ours on a personal level, on a communal level, and I want to give him a yesher kol for all his wonderful work. And of course, I'm sure many of you know he loves Tanakh, and this is sort of, as he said yesterday, truly has a soft spot for it. So I think it's nice he's kicking off the program. So it's a pleasure to work with him in the shul, and I want to thank him for all his efforts and introduce Rabbi Shulman, who will be talking on the Midrash.
Thank you very much. Everybody, Jesus says he picked up as you walked in, so if you don't mind distributing them. The topic for this shiur is the biblical foundations of Midrash. Midrash is generally a term used to describe the broad corpus of rabbinic literature or rabbinic interpretations of the Bible, specific to the time of the Mishnah and the Talmud. And the Midrash is generally a collection of various types of biblical interpretations, stories, events, things that add or shed light significantly to the text of the Bible, the text of the Torah, but aren't necessarily recorded in the Torah. The question becomes, in the study of Midrash, what is the foundation of many of these stories? Did they have some kind of biblical foundation, or did Chazal simply have a tradition of various stories related to our forefathers and ancestors that were not part of the text of Tanakh, but that were recorded in some kind of oral tradition? Or, third option, which is in fact, that many of these stories are rabbis invented, made them up, and used them as literary approaches to the study of Tanakh, as interpretations of the stories of the Bible, as attempts to embellish and add and enhance that which was missing in the text. And there are various examples of such a possible interpretation. What I want to demonstrate this morning, in the time allotted, is that in many cases, not only did that, in fact, none of the above is true. That they didn't make up stories, nor did they necessarily have a tradition, an oral tradition that dates back to Sinai, of events that took place that aren't recorded in the Bible. I'll give you an example. The most famous example that we can use for this story is the background to Abraham. Everybody knows that the story of Abraham begins with God talks to Abraham and he says, go. But the Medrash tells a story. And the Medrash tells a story. We're going to start with that story in a moment. The Medrash tells a story about the background to Abraham's life. What was it that motivated, or that was the impetus for this dialogue between God and Abraham? And the answer is a whole sequence of events related to Abraham and his father Terah, and the idols that his father had, and the destruction of the idols, and then they put him forward into Nimrod, and Nimrod threw him into a fiery furnace, and he emerged from the fiery furnace by some super miracle. And before you know it, we have an entire story of Abraham's life that is recorded in the Medrash in a number of sources, but is not recorded anywhere in the rest of the Bible. And one can ask oneself, was this part of a tradition about Abraham that was part of the oral tradition handed down at Sinai? Or was this a story that Chazal made up in order to embellish that which was missing in the text? Namely, who is this Abraham? Where does he come from? The thesis that I'm going to share with you today, which I learned from my teachers, is that neither of these approaches is correct, and that in fact, what Chazal did, and what our rabbis did, was they didn't invent stories, nor did they have a tradition of these stories. But very often, not always, but what very often they did was they borrowed stories. And they took episodes and events that are recorded in the Bible in completely different locations and contexts, and they superimposed them on other contexts and other stories in order to simply play a sophisticated game of connect the dots. I tell you story A, you are imminently familiar and intimately familiar with story A because you know the Bible backwards and forwards as a rabbi did. So you immediately identify, oh, that story comes from text so and such and such. But the rabbi superimposed that story on a different person. They superimposed it onto Abraham. And now what I have to do is go back to the story in its original, go to the story of Abraham, and try to understand what it was about these two events that the rabbi saw connected. And why did they take the story from place A and superimpose it on place B? And so we have some very famous and very sophisticated midrashic quote-unquote folklore that actually have substantial foundation in the Tanakh itself. But our problem is that we do it backwards. We learn the text of the Bible through the rabbinic interpretations of our rabbis and of the Medrash, rather than the other way around. First, knowing the Bible backwards and forwards and inside out, as a rabbi did, and then seeing the level of interpretation that the rabbis imposed over Tanakh by borrowing stories from one place to another. It's a reflection of a concept that is, or a phrase that appears in the Yerushalmi, Divrei Torah aniyim b'makom achad v'ashirim b'makom acher. The words of the Torah are rich in one place and poor in another, meaning that there are some places in the Torah and the broader literature of Torah, rabbinic literature included, that is wealthy in terms of the text and in terms of the substance, and it's very easy to see what it says and what it means. And in other places where the information is sparse and we have to dig deep in order to understand what exactly the Torah is trying to convey and what our rabbis were trying to convey. And this is a classic example where the rabbis would take stories from one place of Tanakh, literally superimpose them on another, assuming that you, the reader, recognize both and connect the stories. And that is our difficulty with Medrash, is that we do not have enough familiarity with the text of Tanakh itself to be able to make that connection. And so we're going to jump right in. I'll give you a simple example to start with before we start with the story of Abraham, because that's really the most famous and the one that I want to address most directly. But I'll give you a simple example. There is a midrash that says, that identifies the personality of Pinchas with the personality of Eliyahu Hanavi. Midrash says, Pinchas u Eliyahu. Pinchas is Eliyahu. Now, Elijah the prophet lives approximately 600 years after Pinchas, and we know from the story of Pinchas and in Chumash, Parshat Pinchas, and the Parshat Chukat, and in the Parshat Balak, where Pinchas, in an act of zealousness, kills Zimri and the prince of the tribe of Shimon, because they were acting immorally before the entire camp. And nobody else was doing anything about it, so Pinchas took the law into his own hands, kills them, and God says he did right, and he was zealous for God. The identification of Pinchas with Eliyahu says essentially that Pinchas is 600 years old by the time he reaches the story of Elijah, changes his name, and we have a new personality. If I take the Medrash literally, in a face value, then I have a challenge. Namely, do I really accept the tradition, and does it make sense, and is it rational to suggest that our sages thought that Pinchas, the personality of Pinchas, the persona, was in fact 600 years old when he stood on Har Carmel and battled the prophets of Baal? Or does it make more sense to assume that Chazal saw in Pinchas aspects of the story of Elijah and they saw in Elijah aspects of the story of Pinchas. They're both called zealots. Pinchas declares, God declares about Pinchas that he was zealous for God, Kinei LaHashem, and Elijah declares about himself, Kano Kineiti LaHashem Elokai, I was zealous for you, O God, when I killed all the prophets of Baal. They share the story of the violence that was part of their zealousness for God. They also share a downfall. Pinchas' zealousness destroys him, as Elijah's zealousness ultimately destroys his role as a leader of Israel. So there is a double level of connection between Pinchas and Eliyahu, both for the positive and for negative. All of that comparison and all of that analysis is contained in three words. Namely, Pinchas is Elijah. Not to suggest that they are in fact the same personality, but to suggest that if I understand the story of Pinchas and I understand the story of Elijah and I draw the parallels between them, suddenly I illuminate both. That's essentially the kind of example that we're going to deal with. That's a simple example. We're going to get into much more sophisticated ones at this time. If you have any questions, just click your hand and stop me, because I have about 6 hours of material to go through in 45 minutes. And anybody who knows me knows that that's true. We'll do the best we can. Source number one, you have a source page, right? You should have a source page and a book. Source number four. Source number four is the story of Abraham as it appears in the original Midrash. This is the actual source of the story. We are familiar with the text. We are familiar with it orally, but every once in a while it's good to go through the original source. I'm going to read it for the sake of time and brevity in the English. Haran died in the presence of his father Terach. Abihiah said Terach was a manufacturer of idols. Terach was Abraham's father. He once went away somewhere and left Abraham to sell these idols in his place. A man came and wished to buy one. How old are you, Abraham asked him. 50 years, was the reply. Woe to such a man, he exclaimed. You are 50 years old and you would worship a day-old object. At this he became ashamed and departed. On another occasion, a woman came with a plate full of flour and requested him to take this and offer it to them. He took a stick, he broke the idols. Listen carefully to the issues. He took a stick and broke the idols and put the stick in the hand of the largest of these idols. When his father returned, he demanded, what have you done? He said, I cannot conceal it from you, he rejoined. The woman came with a plate full of fine meal and requested me to offer it to them. One of the idols proclaimed, I will eat first. Another idol proclaimed, I will eat first. Thereupon, the largest of these idols took the stick and broke the other ones. To which Terach said to him, why do you make sport of me? That's ridiculous. Everybody knows that idols can't fight each other. Have they any knowledge? To which Abraham responded, let your ears hear what your mouth is saying. So part one of this Midrash, I've divided into two parts intentionally. Part one of this Midrash is a story about Abraham who goes to war with his father's idols. And in so doing, he breaks the idols to demonstrate the fallacy of their potency or of their existence as a deity. Those are the two key pieces of the story. Bear them in mind. We'll come back to them. Then, part two. Thereupon, Terach seized him and delivered him to Nimrod. Now, Nimrod does not appear as a name in the story of Abraham per se, but he does appear in the passages just prior to Abraham's life. Contemporary to the world of Abraham, Nimrod is the king of the land of Shinar, which is the location of the Tower of Babel. Remember the story of Migdal Babel? So essentially, Nimrod is the king in the location that becomes known as the area of Babylon or Babel, although at the time it was called Shinar. So Nimrod says, let us worship the fire. Nimrod proposed. Says Abraham, let us rather worship water, which extinguishes the fire. He replied, then let us worship water. No, says Abraham, let us rather worship the clouds that bear the water. Let us worship the clouds. No, let us rather worship the winds that disperse the clouds. Then let us worship the wind. Let us rather worship human beings who withstand the wind. At which point Nimrod throws up his hands and he says, you are bandying words. We will worship naught but the fire. Behold, I will cast you into it and let your God, whom you adore, come and save you. Now Haran was standing undecided. Haran is Abraham's brother, standing undecided, and he says, if Abraham is victorious, then I will be of Abraham's belief. And if Nimrod is victorious, I will say that I am on Nimrod's side. When Abraham descended into the fiery furnace, he was saved, miraculously. Nimrod then asked Haran, of whose belief are you? And he said, of Abraham's. Whereupon he seized him and cast him into the fire. His inwards were scorched, and he died in his father's presence, as it is written, and Haran died in the presence of his father, of the Terach. The whole story is really there to reflect three words in the text of how Haran died in his father's presence from a Midrashic point of view. My issue is the sources of these stories. So essentially I have two stories. One is Abraham as an individual who goes to battle against his father's idols and destroys his father's idols in order to demonstrate the fallacy of the concept of idolatry. And the second is Abraham who's thrown into the fiery furnace of Nimrod in order to, or as a declaration of his faith, he's refusing to bow down to Nimrod or acknowledge Nimrod's deity. And as a punishment, Nimrod throws him into the fiery furnace. He emerges unscathed. God turns to him and says, Abraham, you're my representative. You are hereby chosen. Those are the two stories. Now, very nice, every child in day school from the age of 5 is taught these two stories, correct?
Yes.
Okay. We are intimately familiar with these stories.
So much so that you believe that they're actually used or
not. Yeah, that's true. If you haven't actually studied the text, you would believe that they are part of the story of Abraham. And it's remarkable when you open up a Chumash and you see that in fact they, in the story of Abraham, they are nowhere to be found. So where are they to be found? The answer to that question is that they are both in Tanakh. They are both there, black and white. The only problem is they're not in the context of the story of Abraham. They are elsewhere, and we need to identify where they are. So now, I've actually, most of the sources that we have in Tanakh, I've actually included in the source pages for you, just to make it a little bit simpler. There's one or two that I wanted you to actually open up a book, because I'm a big believer in opening up the book. So I left one or two out, but we'll start with what's on the page. Where do we have a story of an individual who is charged by God to begin a mission of faith in God? And before he begins this mission, the first thing he does is he destroys his father's idols. That's essentially the story of Abraham, correct? He's told to destroy, or he does, in fact, destroy his father's idols. There is one story in Tanakh where we find exactly that. Anybody know where it is? Well, it's on the page. If you looked ahead, you cheated and looked ahead. It's in fact the story of Gideon. So let's read it together. Gideon is one of the Shoftim in the book of Judges. He's one of the leaders, and he is appointed by God to lead his people against the influx or the invasion of the kingdoms of Midian, Amalek, and Bnei Kedah. And it came to pass that night that God said to Gideon, take your father's young bull, the second bull of 7 years old, and throw down the altar of Baal that your father has, and cut down the Asherah that is by it. And build an altar to God, to the Lord your God, upon the top of this rock, in the ordered place, and then take the second bull and offer a burnt sacrifice with the wood of the Asherah that you cut down. So Gideon is instructed, he's commanded, he's charged, with the responsibility to destroy his father's idols before he can embark on the campaign to fight against the armies of Midian. Gideon then took 10 men of his servants and did as the Lord had said to him. And so it was, because he feared his father's household and the men of the city, that he could not do it by day, he did it by night. He was afraid. Listen, he would walk in with 10 people and destroy his father's idols. That's not such a nice thing to do. So he felt that they would attack him. So what did he do? He did it when nobody was around. He did it in the middle of the night. When did Abraham break his father's idols?
When
his father wasn't there. Sound familiar? And when the men of the city arose early in the morning, behold, the altar of Baal was cast down, and the Asherah, which is a tree that was worshipped, was also cut down, and the second bull was offered upon the altar that was built. And they said to one another, who has done this thing? When they inquired and they asked, they were told, Gidon, son of Joash, has done this thing. So the men of the city said to Joash, the father, the idolatrous father, bring out your son that he may die. Much as Terach said to Abraham, okay, you're going to die. Because he has cast down the altar of Baal, and because he has cast down the Asherah that was with it. And Joash said to all who stood against him, will you fight for Baal? Will you save him? Will you plead for him? He's an idol. Let him be put to death while it is yet morning. If he is a god, let him plead for himself, because one has cast down his altar. If Baal is real, if he's a deity, he can fight his own battles, but he has to fight his battle for him. And suddenly, what's the argument? If an idol is a real power, then let him take care of himself. Much as Abraham said to Terach, they fought each other. And Terach said, oh, idols can't fight each other. And Abraham said, hey, whoa, epiphany, idols can't fight each other. Idols, let the idol take care of himself. And thereupon, on that day, he called to Miru Baal, let Baal plead against him because he has thrown down the wall. In other words, what's my suggestion to you? My suggestion is, the Chazal, they didn't invent the story of Abraham breaking his father's idols. That story of an individual breaking his father's idols in secret, and then demonstrating the fallacy of idolatry in that fashion, is in fact a story in Tanakh. It's a story in Sefer Shoftim. It's a story of Gidon. All Chazal did, all the rabbis did, was borrow the story. They took the story out of its original context, and they superimposed a version of it onto the life of Abraham. Now, why would they do that? So there's several reasons why they would do that. Number one is because there's a whole series of comparisons between Abraham and Gidon, and now we have an exercise. Now we can go through the story of Abraham's life and the story of Gidon's life and see the parallels. And if you're familiar with the stories themselves, you'll know. Abraham at one point goes to war. When he goes to war, he goes to war against the entire empire of Kedar La'omer, much as Gidon goes to war with tens of thousands of soldiers of the empires of Midian and Amalek and Bnei Kedar. Abraham goes to war with 318 soldiers. Gidon goes to war with 300 soldiers. Abraham attacks in the middle of the night. Gidon attacks in the middle of the night. All kinds of parallels between them. But the most important parallel between them is that it puts us into a milieu that we would not have otherwise understood. The story of Gidon is the story of an individual who is charged with a war, not only against their enemies physically, but against a culture of idolatry, pagan idolatry, that is eroding the morality and the spirituality of an entire civilization. And he is told, before you can embark on the military conquest and before you can embark on the protection of Israel as a nation, you must engage a battle against the pagan culture of idolatry, which included child sacrifice, which included virgin rape, which included all kinds of immoral behavior. If I put myself into the world of Abraham, although the text never tells us Abraham's battle against the culture of idolatry, we know the Canaanites. We know their culture. We know their religion. We know their pagan character. And for Abraham to emerge with a loyalty and faith in one God and in the concept of monotheism must mean that he faced similar challenges to those faced by people like Gidon. And whether the story actually took place or not is not my issue. But what the story does is it opens up a world of understanding of the life and the milieu and the struggle that Abraham must have engaged in, regardless of whether it's in the text, for him to emerge in this belief of monotheism. And the example, the proof is in the pudding, the example is the story of Gidon, who lives in a similar milieu, in a similar context, and who fights and was commanded to fight against that idolatry before he can lead his people. And so with a simple game of connected dots, I suddenly have a world of understanding of the life and the milieu of Abraham that I wouldn't have understood otherwise had Chazal not drawn the connection and parallel between Abraham and Gidon. You follow the thesis? Let's do another example. Let's talk about part two There's another piece of it I'm going to skip, which is the breaking of the idols. Where does the breaking of the idols come from? That actually has its own parallel as well in terms of Shmuel Aleph, the story of the ark, but I'm going to skip that for now. Let's talk about Abraham and the fiery furnace. That's probably the most famous story of all. Abraham is going to the fiery furnace of Nimrod. Where does that story come from? This is not on your source page. So here, you're going to have to open your text.
What page?
Okay, in a minute. Daniel chapter 3. Daniel chapter 3 begins on page 900. Remember the elements of the story of Abraham. He is taken to the king of Shinar, also known as Babel, king by the name of Nimrod. And there he is challenged with the deity of Nimrod and thrown into the fiery furnace, and he emerges unscathed. Here is the story in Daniel chapter 3. I'm going to read it in English. Nebuchadnezzar is the king of Babel. Nebuchadnezzar the king made an image of gold, whose height was 60 cubits, approximately 90 feet, and the breadth of which was 6 cubits. He set it up in the plain of Dura, in the province of Babel. Then Nebuchadnezzar the king sent to gather together the satraps, the prefects, the governors, the counselors, the treasurers, the justices, the magistrates, and all the rulers of the provinces, that's a mouthful, to come to the dedication of the image which Nebuchadnezzar the king had set up. Then the satraps, the prefects, and the governors, the counselors, the treasurers, the justices, the magistrates, and all the rulers of the provinces were gathered together to the dedication of the image that Nebuchadnezzar the king had set up. And they stood before the image that Nebuchadnezzar had set up. And the herald cried out and said, "To all of you is commanded, O people, nations, and tongues, when you hear the sound of the horn, pipe, lyre, trigon, harp, bagpipe, and all kinds of music, you will fall down and worship the golden image that Nebuchadnezzar the king has set up. And whoever does not fall down and worship shall be cast into the midst of the burning fiery furnace." Sound familiar?
Yeah.
Therefore, at that time, when all the people heard the sound of the horn, the pipe, the lyre, the trigon, the harp, and the kinds of music, all the peoples, nations, and tongues fell down and worshipped the golden image that Nebuchadnezzar the king had set up. Therefore, at that time, certain Chaldeans came near and accused the Jews. They spoke and said to the king Nebuchadnezzar, "There live, O king, live forever. You, king, has made a decree that every man who shall hear the sound of the horn, the pipe, the lyre, the trigon, the harp, the bagpipe, and all kinds of music shall fall down," it's a little repetitive, but that's all right, "shall fall down and worship the golden image. And whoever does not fall down shall be cast into the midst of the fiery furnace. There are certain Jews whom you have set over the affairs of the province of Babel, by the name of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, otherwise known by their Hebrew names as Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, the three disciples of Daniel. These men, O king, have not regarded thee. They do not serve thy gods, nor worship the golden image which you have set up." Nebuchadnezzar, in his rage and fury, commanded to bring Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. They brought these men before the king. Nebuchadnezzar spoke, and he said to them, "Is it true, O Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, that you do not serve my God, nor worship the golden image which I have set up? If you are ready, when you hear the sound of the horn, the pipe, the lyre, the trigon, the harp, the bagpipe, and all kinds of music, to fall down and worship the image that I have made, well and good. And if you do not, you shall be cast into the same hour into the midst of the burning fiery furnace. And who is the God who shall deliver you out of my hands?" Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego answered the king and said, "O Nebuchadnezzar, we have no need to answer you in this manner. Behold, our God whom we serve is able to deliver us. He can deliver us from the burning fiery furnace and out of thy hand, O king. And if he does not, he is known to thee, O king, that we will not serve thy gods nor worship the golden image which you have set up." In other words, what Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah did is exactly the opposite of what Haran did in the story. What Haran did was, "I'll hedge my bets. I'll watch and I'll see. Yeah? Pick sides." Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah were prepared to give up their lives rather than bow down to Nebuchadnezzar's golden image. Then was Nebuchadnezzar full of fury, and the expression of his visage was changed against Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, and he spoke, and he commanded that they should heat the furnace 7 times more than it was wont to be heated. And he commanded them as mighty men that were in his army to bind Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, and cast them into the burning fiery furnace. And then these men were bound in their mantles, their tunics, and their hats, and their other garments. They were cast into the midst of the burning fiery furnace. King's commandment was urgent, the furnace exceedingly hot, the flame of the fire slew those men that had seized Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. The people who threw the 3 Jews into the furnace, it was so hot that they died from the proximity. And these 3 men, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, fell down bound into the midst of the burning fiery furnace. Then Nebuchadnezzar the king was astonished, and he rose up in haste, and he spoke, and he said to his counselors, "Did we not cast 3 men bound into the midst of the fire?" And they answered the king and said, "True, O king." And he answered and said, "Lo, I see 4 men unbound walking in the midst of the fire, and they have no hurt, and the appearance of the 4th is like an angel." And the Nebuchadnezzar came near to the mouth of the burning fiery furnace, and he spoke and he said, "Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, servants of the Most High God, come out and come here." Then Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego came out of the midst of the fire, and the rest of the story you can imagine. So where did Chazal get the story of Abraham in the fiery furnace of Nimrod in the kingdom of Shinar? It's a story. It's not a folklore. It's a story in Tanakh. It's the story of Hanani, Mishael, and Azariah in the fiery furnace of Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babel. It's almost verbatim. So what did Chazal do? They took the life and times of Abraham, and they superimposed into the world of Abraham the story of Hanani, Mishael, and Azariah in the same location, almost 1,000 years later, struggling with exactly the same issues of belief in monotheism and the faith set in place by Abraham. The faith to which Hanani, Mishael, and Azariah are pleading their allegiance at the risk of being thrown into the fiery furnace is precisely the same faith that Abraham set forth. And so it makes sense to suggest that Abraham would have undergone a similar, or could have undergone a similar kind of experience. You know what they say about Hasidic stories? What they say about Hasidic stories? Are they true? And the answer is, they could be. I don't know. That's exactly what Chazal did with Abraham. Is it true? Is it historical? Is it historical? I don't know. But it could be. How do I know it could be? Because 1,000 years later, that's exactly what happened. On the basis of the faith that Abraham set forth, that's exactly the struggle that Hanani, Mishael, and Azariah faced. And I take 1,000 years of struggle of the Jewish people against the institution of pagan idolatry, the story of Gideon, which is approximately about 600 years after Abraham, and the story of Hanani, Mishael, and Azariah, which is 1,500 years after Abraham, and I superimpose all of that back into the life of Abraham, and I link the end of the biblical period with the beginning of the biblical period, and I link the struggle against pagan idolatry with which Tanakh is essentially a record, and I link it back to the origins and the roots, which starts with Abraham. And all of that in one folklore, on the assuming that you, the reader, know the Tanakh well enough to identify the source of the story. In the case of Abraham, however, the story goes one step deeper, because the significance of Nebuchadnezzar has a particular characteristic, and that is the story of Migdol Babel. Nebuchadnezzar, I'm going to take this in my hand because my voice is gone, so you'll talk to me, you'll bear with me, and that'll make it a little bit easier. Thank you. The story of Nebuchadnezzar is, in fact, the story of an individual, a king, who stands up in top of his palace, part of the story that we didn't read, but I'll review or summarize for you briefly the story of Nebuchadnezzar, stands up in the top of his palace. Nebuchadnezzar conquers the entire world. Nebuchadnezzar stands before the entire palace and he declares that this is my kingdom which I have conquered with my hands.
And immediately God appears to him and says to him, Nebuchadnezzar, you are going to spend the next 7 years as a beast of the field until you learn a little bit of humility, and until you learn that it is I, God, who has given you this kingdom, and not you by the work of your own hands that have made this kingdom. That's really the story of Nebuchadnezzar. Now that story has a biblical precedent. Of a king who stands at the top of his palace and looks out at the entire globe and the entire world and civilization and says, this is my kingdom, I own it, I have conquered it, I have made it, it is mine. That is precisely the story of the Tower of Babel, in the most rational understanding of that episode. When the entire world is of one language and of one thought, says the Sforno, and you have it on your source page.
Page 3,
source number 11. Says the Sforno, this was the intent of the elders of that generation, the Tower of Babel. Nimrod is the king of Shinar. The tower is built in the valley of Shinar. The tower, a Migdal, in biblical terms, was the fortress of a city where the king usually sat. And so this tower, which was elevated into the heavens, it's not clear in the Bible why God goes to battle against this tower. What's so terrible about a tower that with the head in the heavens? So Rashi says they wanted to throw God out of the heavens. But in the chat, there's no indication that they had any theological implications of trying to throw God out of the heavens. Says this one, all they wanted to do was create a palace and a fortress for their king. Who was their king? Nimrod. And Nimrod would stand at the top of this palace, and Nimrod would declare, this whole kingdom, the entire civilization of humankind that I have conquered with my hands, I am king over the entire world. You know what the Nebuchadnezzar is called in Sefer Daniel? He's called Melech HaMelechim, King of Kings. Which is why whenever we refer to the Rebbe Lishol, we always refer to him as Melech Malchei HaMelechim, the King of the King of Kings. We add one. Because of the chutzpah of Nebuchadnezzar to call himself King of Kings. Nimrod called himself King of Kings, King over the entire world. The Ribbono Shel Olam is the King of the King of Kings. And that was precisely the message that Nebuchadnezzar had to learn when he spent 7 years as a beast of the field, and that's precisely what God did to Migdal Babel. You, Nimrod, you think you are king over the entire world? I will show you what unity is all about. Unity is very nice, as long as it's for a good purpose. Unity for an evil purpose can be very dangerous. In World War II, the world learned that the hard way. Unity isn't always a good thing. And so Nimrod and his unified kingdom that declared Nimrod king of the world had to be destroyed. So here's the clincher. According to the calculations of the chronology of the Bible, there's a medrash that says Abraham is 48 years old when he discovers God. We're familiar with the medrash that says he was 3 years old. But the fact is that the Medrash that says he's 3 also says, another opinion says he's 48 years old. You can imagine, why on earth would they pick a number like that out of the hat? What made Abraham 48 years old when he discovered God? The answer is, if you go through the chronology of the Bible carefully, you'll see that there's an event that takes place in Abraham's life when he's 48 years old that is so transformative, it sets Abraham on a path to discover God. That event is the Tower of Babel. Abraham doesn't discover God because he looks into the heavens and he sees God as somebody must have created this. Abraham looks into history and he sees the hand of God. And he saw the events of Migdal Babel and he understood that there was a struggle and a fight going on between who was really the King of Kings or the King of King of Kings. Much as that same battle takes place in the world of Nebuchadnezzar and the Ribbono Shel Olam in Sefer Daniel. All of that is connected and demonstrated through this one midrashic folklore that says, before you can understand the story of Abraham, go read the story of Daniel, understand it well, and then go back to the story of Abraham, and suddenly everything makes sense. That's what I call the biblical foundations of midrash. It's not folklore. It's biblical interpretation. It's pshat. It's literal interpretation. But it's based on an assumption that these stories are familiar to you, and you will go to their source, and then work your way backwards. I'm going to try to fly through a couple of other little examples, and then I want to, time permitting, do one more I believe, a powerful example that's actually relevant to Purim, and we're a month away from Purim, so that's always good. Yes, Pastor.
The process that Chazal went through to, that you're saying that they borrowed and actually from the Midrashim, did they say their process?
No.
Is that like a big
the only thing you have is that quote that I made, that I offered at the beginning, Divrei Torah, Aneim b'makom achad, Ashirim b'makom acher. The words of Torah are rich in one place and impoverished somewhere else. And to have a full picture of Torah, I have to link everything together and put it together like a chunk. That's the only thing we have. Chazal never explicitly expressed a methodology in any area, not only in Midrash, but in general. The methodology is left for us to address. But it's clear that that is their methodology in many instances. I brought together many sources, about 8 or 9 examples, but we've only done one, if you get the idea. Yeah.
What is this concept of Midrash Halakha and Midrash Agadah with this?
Midrash Halakha and Midrash Agadah are two completely different genres. Midrash Halakha is a textual analysis of the Torah for the purpose of deriving halachic, legal understanding of the laws of the Torah. Midrash Agadah is the homiletic, agadic interpretation of the story for the purpose of learning the lessons. We are discussing Midrash Agadah. We are not discussing at all the Midrash Halakha. They are two completely different books. The fact that they're both called Midrash is really misleading. If you ask the average person and talk about Medrash and whatever they mean by that, they're usually referring to Midrash Agadah. Midrash Halakha is the forerunner to the Mishnah. When we talk about Mishnah, we usually don't refer to Medrash. It's a whole different issue. Okay. I'll give you another example, a classic example. Abraham and the Akedah. You are, I'm sure, no doubt familiar with Rashi, the beginning of the story of the Akedah. Why is it that God comes to test Abraham? I'll come to the page in a second. Abraham was tested in the story of the binding of Isaac. Verse begins, Elohim nisa et Abraham. Why is it that God tests Abraham? So Rashi, beginning of the story, quotes a Medrash. What does the Medrash say? Anybody know? Okay, so take a look at source 14. Gemara in Sanhedrin, Daf Pei Tet Amud Bet, 89b. Again, I'll read in English. And it came to pass after these words that God tempted Abraham, or tested Abraham, is probably a better translation. What is meant by after these words? Acharei Panim Ela. Rabbi Yochanan said on the authority of Rabbi Yossi ben Zimra, after the words of the Satan. Now, the Satan is a very complicated story in Jewish literature. But Chazal introduced the Satan into the story of Abraham. As it is written, and the child grew and was weaned, and Abraham made a great feast for the same day that Isaac was weaned. Thereupon the Satan, or Satan, said to the Almighty, Sovereign of the universe, to this old man thou did graciously vouchsafe the fruit of the womb of the age of 100, yet all of the banquet which he has prepared, he did not have one turtle dove or pigeon to sacrifice before you. Made a whole party for his son, didn't bring a single carbon to you. That's who you gave this child to at the age of 100, says the Satan. Had he done aught but in honor of his son, he's only done that which is good for himself, said God. Yet were I to say to him, sacrifice your son before me, he would do so without hesitation, says God to the Satan. Straight away God tempted Abraham, or tested Abraham. In other words, the Medrash suggests, and it's one interpretation, but the Medrash suggests that the background to the story of the Akedah is an argument that God has with the, I don't know what you want to call Satan, but let's call it the Satan. God has an argument with Satan over the loyalty of Abraham. And in order to prove to the Satan that Abraham is loyal, he tests him in such a fashion. That's the Medrash. Rashi quotes at the beginning of Chumash. And you read this Rashi, and you read this Medrash, and you stand there shocked. Because, where did this come from? What, throws Satan into the middle of the story of Abraham? I guarantee you it's not in the text. So where does it come from? The answer is, it's very simple. Chazal knew exactly where it came from. Chazal knew exactly where they borrowed it from. They borrowed it from the opening chapter of the book of Job. I'll read the opening chapter of the book of Job and you'll see it very clearly. Source 15 on the top of page 4. Now there was a day when the sons of God came to present themselves before God, and Satan came also among them. And the Lord said to Satan, "Where are you coming from?" And Satan answered and said, "From going forth to and fro in the earth, and from walking up and down in it." And the Lord said to Satan, "Okay, so you've just spent the day spaziering in my world. Have you considered my servant Job? There is none like him in the earth, a blameless and upright man, one who fears God and turns away from evil. Yireh Elokim." Does the word expression Yireh Elokim sound familiar? Who else is called Yireh Elokim? Abraham is called after the Akedah. "Now I know that you fear God." Then Satan answered the Lord, "Does Job fear God for nothing? Have you not made a hedge around him and around his house and around all that he has? On every side, you have blessed the work of his hands, and his possessions are increased in the land. And Job is sitting at the top of his game. He's a judge, and he's wealthy, and he has a family, and he's happy, and of course he's going to serve God. What else would he do? He's a happy-go-lucky guy. He's got everything waiting for him. But put forth your hand and touch all that he has, and he will curse you to your face. Destroy that which he had, take away all the blessings that you've given him, and then see if he will bless you." Thereupon God said to Satan, "Behold, all that he has is in your power. Only upon himself put not forth your hand." So Satan went forth in the presence of the Lord, and the rest of the story of Job is history. In other words, the book of Job opens up with a conflict between God and Satan. Whatever that means, I'm not going to get into the concept of the symbol of the Satan in Jewish literature. But the concept is that the challenge, the test to the Nisayon, to Job, which is just that, the test, everything that he has in his prized possessions are taken away from him to test the loyalty, even in the time of anguish and trouble, rather than just in the time of blessing. Doesn't that sound even remotely similar to the story of Abraham? In the Akedah, where everything he has worked for his entire life, his entire essence and dream and future is told, he's told to essentially that it will go up in smoke when he takes his son Isaac and binds him as a sacrifice on the altar. So Chazal superimposed the story of the introduction of the book of Job into the story of Abraham so that we would link Abraham and Job. And now go and link them. Now go compare them. Wow, there's a huge comparison between Abraham and Job. So let's go through the analogy. Abraham is asked to sacrifice his only son. Job is asked to sacrifice everything that he worked for and everything that he has. Abraham is tested. Job is tested. Abraham declares, "Anochi afar ve'efer, I am nothing but dust in the earth." That expression appears only twice in all of Tanakh. Once by Abraham and once by, you guessed it, Job. Source 16. But there the comparison changes, because it's a comparison of contrast. Job, whereas Abraham goes forth in the Akedah with silent devotion, whatever the anguish, whatever the pain, he doesn't argue, and he goes forth with a conspicuous silence. 3 days journey, he walks with the sun until he reaches the place that God tells him. And in those 3 days, what does Abraham say? Nothing. Not a word. Job, on the other hand, spends 30 some odd chapters riling against God, fighting against God, lambasting God, struggling with his friends. There's nothing but talk and criticism and judgment in the book of Job. If anything, the story of the comparison between Abraham and Job is a story of contrast. You have a much deeper appreciation for the greatness and the depth of Abraham when you compare Abraham against the backdrop of the failure of Job. All of that contained in one medrash that takes the story of the introduction of Job and superimposes it into the story of the introduction of Abraham. And suddenly connecting the dots, we, the reader, say to ourselves, where are Chazal leading us? They're leading us to a very profound place and a very profound understanding of the depth of the pshat in the story of Abraham. Another example. You had a question?
Yeah. What percentage of Midrashim can you find a connection?
Well, I've been working on this for a long time. I learned this thesis about 20 years ago, and as I go through my learning of Tanakh and my teaching of Tanakh, I'm sort of keeping a running tab. There are many. I can't tell you how many. I just, for this discussion here, I pulled together 8 or 9 very famous, very obvious ones. And I'm going to try to start running through them rather than doing them slowly. You've got the idea of the methodology. I'm going to start running through examples. I can't tell you all of them, but I can tell you a significant pattern, significant enough to be a very powerful methodology in understanding many midrash. And I'll give you another couple of famous examples. This I'll do verbally or orally with you just for the sake of time. Moshe Rabbeinu. Let's shift our focus from Abraham. Moshe Rabbeinu. God chooses Moshe to be the leader of the Jewish people. How do we know? Well, that's not my question. The question is, what did God see in Moshe to make him choose Moshe as the leader?
Well, Moshe was very, very, he wasn't materialistic. That whole story of coals,
Well, the story of the coals also doesn't appear in Tanakh. That's also Medrash. I haven't found the biblical source for that one yet, but I'm still looking. Moshe had a little lamb. And everywhere that Moshe went, the lamb was short to go. Moshe is a shepherd. And the Medrash paints a beautiful picture. It's actually source number 17. Moshe was tested by God through sheep. A rabbi said that when Moses, a teacher, peace be upon him, was tending the flock of Yitro in the wilderness, a little kid escaped from him, Chad Gadya, and he ran after it until he reached a shady place. When he reached the shady place, there appeared to be the view of a pool of water, and the kid stopped to drink, and Moses approached and he said, I didn't know that you ran away because you were thirsty, you must be weary. And he placed the kid upon his shoulder, and he walked away. Thereupon God said, because you have mercy in the leading of this flock of a mortal, you will surely tend to my flock, Israel. Beautiful story. Where does it come from? Anybody familiar with the story of a future leader of our people who goes looking for a lost animal and discovers in that process that he is going to be appointed as the next leader of the Jewish people? Shaul HaMelech. King Saul goes looking on it. He goes on a mission. And you have it in source 18. So King Saul, well, he wasn't king, he was just Saul at the time. His father's name is Kish. Kish lost his donkey. And he sent Saul looking for his donkey. And Kish said to Saul, take now one of your servants with you and rise, go seek the asses or the donkeys. And he passed through the mountain of Ephraim, and he passed through the land of Shalisha, and they could not find them. Thereupon they passed through the land of Shalim, and they weren't there. And he passed through the land of Binyamin, and they weren't there. And when they finally came to the land of Suf, Saul said to his servant who was with him, come, let us return, lest my father cease to care about the donkeys and become worried about us. He's been gone for 3 days. And the lad said to him, behold, there is in the city a man of God, a prophet by the name of Shmuel. And he's an honorable man. And all that he says comes surely to pass. Let's go there, and perhaps he can tell us where we should find our donkeys. Well, guess what? They come to Shmuel HaNavi, and they ask him where his donkeys are, and before they get a chance to open up their mouth, Shmuel says to Shaul, I was told by God that you were going to come to me. You are hereby appointed as the next king of Israel. Shmuel Aleph Perekat. Sound familiar? Man goes looking for his lost animal, finds it, and in so doing, finds the burning bush. In the case of Moshe, finds Shmuel HaNavi and the revelation about his being prophet, that being the next king of Israel in the case of Shmuel. What time will you finish?
10:25.
The next session is 10:25. Okay. Okay. We'll try to wrap up as quickly as I can. Shaul and Shmosha. So suddenly, what did Chazal do? They took the story about Shaul. And again, they superimpose it on the story of Moshe. And in so doing, what did they express? They said, well, wait a second, now start an exercise of comparison between Moshe and Shaul. Oh, here we could spend a whole shiur and a half talking about the comparisons between Moshe and Shaul. Some of you actually did that with me once before. We could analyze Moshe's humility, Vayish Moshe Anav Mikol Adam, to Saul's humility. At the inauguration ceremony of King Saul, they look for him. He's told he's going to be the next king of Israel. The lot, the goral falls on Saul. He's anointed. They announce, here it is. Drum roll, please. Saul, King Saul. And guess what? He's not there. He's hiding amongst the baggage. because who am I to be king? Wonderful modesty, wonderful anivus. Like Moshe refused at the burning bush for how many days to go as the mission to Pharaoh. Mi anochi ki elecho paro, said Shmuel, who am I and who is my family that I should go to be king of Israel? But again, you understand that the comparison is not only a parallel, but also a contrast. Moshe is modest, but his modesty doesn't stop him from standing up to Pharaoh and telling Pharaoh, "Bina reinu bizkenin and elech, we are leaving Egypt and we are leaving with our children and with our wives and with our sons and with our daughters." Doesn't stop him from standing up to Korach and Korach's rebellion. Doesn't stop him from standing up to God when the Jewish people are sinned to the golden calf and telling God, if you forgive them, good, and if you don't, wipe me out of the book that you have written. On the other hand, Saul's humility causes him constantly to follow the people rather than to follow God. And ultimately, it leads to the downfall of his own kingdom, to the point where the last thing that Shmuel Hanavi says to Saul in the aftermath of the failure of the Battle of Amalek is, In katon atav einecha, rosh shiftei Yisrael ata. You may think yourself small in your own eyes, but you are the leader of the people of Israel. And there's a place for modesty, and there's a place for false modesty, and there's no place for false modesty. And if you're the leader of the people of Israel, you have to stand up to that responsibility. And so the modesty of Moshe contrasted with the modesty of Shmuel is actually a comparison and contrast. And suddenly, the link between Saul and Moshe in a little story about a Shepselah opens up a whole world of understanding into the life of both of them. That's Nefesh. That's what Chazal were trying to do. They weren't playing games, and they weren't telling folklore. They were analyzing Tanakh, and they were drawing parallels, and they were linking the dots, and they were telling you a depth of a world of understanding. But you have to understand the Nefesh. Quickly, I'm going to review two other styles of the same approach, and then I'm going to conclude, hopefully, with a part about Purim. You'll have something for the Purim Seder, the Purim Suda for you. Similar, although in a different type of genre, we have a series of Midrashei Chazal that have the following structure, and analyze an analysis of various passages in the Torah that juxtapose one mitzvah with another. There are various places in the Torah where the Torah links, lists mitzvot, one after the other, and Chazal take a step back and say, oh, these things are not just arbitrarily linked, there's a connection between them. So for example, in source 24, the beginning of Devarim Perek of Aleph, beginning of Parashat Ki Tetzeh, lists the following three mitzvot. The first is called Eshet Yifat Toar, where if you go to battle and you find a wife in the midst of the enemies, it is permissible to take that woman into your house, not necessarily to be encouraged, but permissible. A time of war, Chazal saw it as a concession to human nature in the heat of battle. The next passage is if a person has more than one wife, he has two wives, he loves one and he hates the other. The firstborn belongs to the one he hates. He has to make sure that the firstborn is given his rights due and he can't favor one over the other. And the third story is the rebellious child, the Ben Sora or Mora, who has to be put to death because his rebellion has reached such critical state. And Chazal linked the three. Chazal is saying, source 24, it's actually a Medrash, but I'll quote it from Rashi, Lo digra Torah ela keneged Yetzahara, the Torah speaks in context of the Yetzahara, if the Torah didn't allow this man to marry her, he would have married her anyway. But if he marries her, says the Torah, in the end he will hate her, as it talks about two wives, and any child born is likely to become a rebellious child because he grows up in such a dysfunctional home. That's how Chazal saw the link between the three stories. Now, one can argue that that's simply a function of a textual analysis. They saw three mitzvot, unrelated to each other, linked the three, and understood the parsha. But I suspect that what Chazal actually did was, they saw, in the stories of Tanakh, examples of the linkage between these three mitzvot. And they took that example from Tanakh, and they superimposed it back, and they said, oh, you know what, this is so obvious, because look at story X. And in fact, in the Midrashic source of this, it says so explicitly. Source 25 is Rashi's source, the Medrash Tanchuma. which says, Kol man denasiv yifat Torah, anybody who marries a yifat Torah, this woman, a captive woman in the time of battle, nafik minayu ben sora lomar, eventually what will come about is a rebellious child, a ben sora umora. How do I know? Shechein matzinu b'David. Because that's exactly what you have in the story of David. Now the story of David, the Medrash actually continues to talk about the birth of Avshalom. But the truth is that the more obvious case is the case of Bathsheba. The story of David and Bathsheba, which is in a certain sense a case of Yifat Torah, because he sees her and he falls in love with her and he sends her husband off to battle, is followed immediately by the story of Amnon and Tamar. And Amnon and Tamar is the rape of Tamar, David's son, by Amnon, her brother, which leads to the rebellion of Absalom. And if you want to talk about an example of a rebellious child, there you have it. And if you want to talk about the link between Eshet Yifat Torah and Ben Sora Umora, there's nothing more obvious than the story of David. Which came first, the chicken or the egg? That's a good question. But I suspect in this case, it was the story of David that stood in the forefront of Chazal's mind when they saw in these passages a link between one story and the next. I'll give you another example. There's a very strange Gemara in Brachos that says that anybody who sees a sota, you know what a sota is, right? The suspected woman of a woman suspected of idolatry and has to go through an entire ritual in the temple and embarrassment in order to determine whether or not she's really guilty, whatever the story is, but the result is, says the Gemara, whoever sees a sota in her the kilkula, in her embarrassment, yazirat mumin el yayin, has to become a nazir. A nazirite. What's the connection between a sota and a nazir? Can you find me a rational explanation of the link between a sota and a nazir? The answer is, I will show you a biblical story of a sota and a nazir in one persona. Which personality in Tanakh is guilty of inappropriate behavior with women more than any other besides David HaMelech? We'll leave the story of David out for the moment. Shimshon. And who's the most famous Nazir in Jewish history? Shimshon. And we can now analyze the relationship between the context of Shimshon's lust for women and his Nazirut and the balance between them. And it could be an entire study of it. From this simple juxtaposition of two mitzvot. And there are many such examples. The one that I like the most, but I'm not going to have time to go into it, so I'm going to just tell you, is the story of Pinchas and Yiftach. You know the story of Yiftach? Yiftach takes an oath. And then in the midst of battle, Yiftach is one of the judges, takes an oath in the midst of battle that if whoever walks, the first thing or the first person to walk out of his house will be offered as a sacrifice to God. Comes home from battle, and who walks out to greet him? None other than his only daughter. And he says, well, terrible tragedy, now I have to offer as a sacrifice to God. And that's what he does. I've always, complete aside and unrelated to our discussion, I've always been bothered by the question of what did Yiftach expect to walk out of his house? His wife? What was he expecting when he takes such an oath? The first person to walk out of my house will be sacrificed to God. Oh, it's his only daughter. Knew what was it supposed to be? His mother-in-law? What was he expecting? Who was he expecting?
An animal.
An animal lives in his house?
A dog.
Right? A dog. And a dog is a kosher sacrifice? Since when do you keep a sheep or a chicken in your house? There's a huge problem in the context of the story. Huge problem. We're not studying Sefer Shoftim right now, so I leave that with you only as a question. I don't have time to answer it now. But the real tragedy is that Chazal turned to Yiftach and they say, well, there's a simple mechanism. He could have annulled his oath. Why didn't he annul his oath? So here's the Medrash. The Medrash says he didn't annul his oath because the priest at the time was a man by the name of Pinchas. Sound familiar?
Yeah.
And said Chazal, Pinchas said, I'm the high priest, why should I go and annul the oath? He should come to me. And Yiftach said, well, I'm the leader, I'm the shofet, I'm the judge, I'm the king, why should I go to the high priest? Let him come to me. And in the meantime, between Shimshon's pride, between Yiftah's pride and Pinchas's pride, the result was that the daughter died. Now, I've been through the story of Yiftach backwards and forwards and inside and out many times. I've never found Pinchas mentioned in that story anywhere. It's not there. So how did Chazal throw Pinchas into the story? And annulling oaths, Hatarat Nidarim, and annulling oaths as the theme of the story of Yiftach. It's not there. Where did they get it from? The answer is very simple. Pinchas does appear in Sefer Shoftim in a different story altogether. The story is the story of Pelegish Begiva. And unfortunately, I haven't had time to go through the story of Pelegish Begiva, but just take understand the following. The tragedy of the story of Pelegish Begiva is that they take two oaths. One oath is to go to war against Binyamin and not to allow any of their sons to marry the daughters of Binyamin. They wipe out all the men of Binyamin, and now they're left with the problem of Binyamin being eradicated as a tribe. Then they take a second oath, that anybody who doesn't come to fight against Binyamin will be put to death. And they discover that the city of Eshgilad, which is on the other side of the Jordan River, never came to fight. So what do? They go to the high priest, whose name is Pinchas, who Pinchas ben Elazar ben Aaron HaKohen, Omed Lifnei Elokim Bayamim Mahen. Pinchas is there. And they go to Pinchas, and Pinchas takes them on a battle against Eshgilad to destroy them because they dared not obey the oath of the king to eradicate the tribe of Binyamin. If there's any place in Tanakh where they should have annulled the oath, it was there, two oaths, that neither one of them should have ever taken place. And Chazal found Pinchas guilty of not annulling the oath of Pelegish Begiva, and they superimposed that story into the story of Yiftach. Why? I don't have time to go into this, I'm going to leave it. But I want to leave you with one last piece.
Purim.
And I know I'm over my time, but Rabbi Kelman will forgive me for this one, because this is the punchline. We are a month away from Purim, literally. The most famous Midrash Chazal of all, with regards to Purim, is a Gemara in Shabbos that says that when the Jewish people stood at Mount Sinai, God held the mountain over their heads like a cask, and said to them, if you accept my Torah, good, and if you don't, I will bury you beneath this mountain. And the Gemara says that at that point, one of the sages stood up and declared, Mikan Madar Rabba L'Araisa, here we have an excuse to annul the Torah, because it's proof that we were forced into its acceptance. To which the Gemara answered, don't worry. Hadar Kiblua B'Mei HaShverosh, they re-accepted, reaffirmed the Torah in the days of Achashverosh and the story of Purim, as it says, Kimu v'kibu, the Jews accepted upon themselves the fulfillment of the days of Purim. Kimu mashikibu kvar, they reaffirmed that which they had established earlier, namely the Torah. Beautiful medrash. I've been to Megillat Esther many times. I lay in Megillat Esther every year. I've read the story backwards and forwards. I have never found a place in the text of Megillat Esther where it says that the Jews accepted the Torah, only that they accepted the days of Purim. So why did Chazal throw into the story of Megillat Esther a concept of the acceptance of the Torah? Where does that come from? Well, the answer is the Chazal saw, almost contemporary to the story of Purim, a very explicit story of the acceptance of the Torah by that generation. The story is in the book of Nehemiah, but you have to know the book of Nehemiah to understand the story. And it's the last source in the booklet, source 42, Nehemiah, as he returns with all the Jews from the Babylonian exile, stands before God with a group of people who are intermarried and who are idolatrous and who are not necessarily what we would expect to be called God obscenities. And he has an entire campaign to rid the people of the idolatry and rid them of the Gentile wives and to reaffirm their commitment to Torah. And in so doing, he declares the following. Nehemiah Peretet, behold, we are slaves today. They are in the land of Israel, but they are slaves because they are under foreign rule. And with respect to the land that you gave to our fathers to eat, and its fruit and its goods, behold, we are slaves on this land, and it's an abundant yield goes to kings whom you have set upon us because of our sins. They also have power over our bodies and over our cattle and in their pleasure, and we are in great distress, and because of or despite all of this, despite all of this, We make a firm covenant and write it, our princes and Levites and priests, and set their seal to it. And they join with their brothers and nobles and enter into a curse and an oath to walk in God's Torah, which was given by Moses, the servant of God, and to observe unto all the commandments of the Lord our God, and to his judgments and his statutes. And we will not give our daughters to the peoples of the land, nor take the daughters for our sons. And if the peoples of the land bring ware or any grain on the Sabbath day to sell, we will not buy it from them on the Sabbath or on the holy day. And we will forego the crops of the seventh year and the exaction of every debt. And kitzer, we will observe the Torah. And they, if you want to talk about a reaffirmation of the Torah, there, that's it. Ketav Amanah, signed, sealed, and delivered. You'll ask the question, why do they need to reaffirm the Torah that was given to us at Sinai? The answer is that the Brit, the covenant at Sinai, was predicated upon the redemption from Egypt. The moment we went into exile, that covenant ostensibly became null and void. He sent us back into slavery. And in fact, when people come to Yechezkel, the prophet, and they say to him, that's it, we're in exile, we could be like all the nations of the world, the covenant's over. And the prophets fight against that and say, no, the covenant is permanent, it's eternal. And when the Jews finally come back 70 years later from the Babylonian exile, they're intermarried and they're idolaters because they've thrown it all away. And they come back to the land of Israel and they're still slaves and they're still oppressed and they're still under foreign occupation and nothing's changed. Except for the first time, they're prepared to accept the Torah despite all of their subjugation under foreign power. Why? What changed? What transformed the ideology of the Jewish people so significantly that they could understand that even despite the exile and despite the oppression, despite the foreign occupation, they could still affirm their covenant with God and their loyalty to God? That's where Chazal pointed to Megillat Esther, which happened in the Babylonian exile in the interim. What Chazal did is they took the story of the acceptance of the Torah in Daniel, in Nehemiah, and they said, you want to know where it comes from? The source? The motivation? Because in the story of Purim, they discovered for the first time in their lives, after 1500 years of history, they discovered that without the temple, and without the kingdom, and without the land, and without prophets, and without miracles, they could still be protected by God. And they could still affirm their affirmation to God and to God's covenant. And so when they finally do return, they reaffirm their commitment to Torah in an entire ceremony recorded in Nehemiah chapter 9, and the Chazal superimposed that story into Megillat Esther in order to link the dots. Enjoy.
Yes, Shekoah.
Okay. Thank you very much.